This Thursday is our national holiday of Thanksgiving. And as you know, Thanksgiving is generally regarded as having first been celebrated by the Pilgrims and the Native Americans in colonial New England, early 17th century. It was to celebrate and give thanks to God for the Pilgrims' first harvest in America. Well, Professor Baird is actually related to the Winslows. They were a big part of that, and so you might want to ask him about it. Sadly, though, many American households today, well, the Thanksgiving celebration has lost, I think, at least some of its original significance, because today we often see it as a time to get together and argue with family, overeat, to watch parades and football, to fall asleep in a recliner, to get ready for the sales on Black Friday. But let's not forget what it's really about: thanking God for all that He's given to us, all that He has done for us. This is actually a wonderful holiday. Okay, if you would, let's be turning to James chapter 5. Here is the list of the richest people in 2018. As you can see, I'm no longer on the list. We're often fascinated by the rich and famous. I mean, we read articles and books, we watch TV shows, and we watch movies about these people who, in some way or another, either through just dumb luck or through really hard work, they became extremely rich. And we often dream of what it might be like to be rich ourselves. You know, instead of worshiping in this old church building, well, we could be worshiping on my super yacht. That'd get attendance up. Well, earlier in the book, James, he spoke of the rich fading like a wildflower in the heat in chapter 1. He also accused the rich of exploiting Christians, dragging them into court, and blaspheming the fair name by which they have been called, chapter 2. That is actually mild compared to what James said about the rich in this section. It was obviously a real problem in that day. Now, there is nothing sinful in being wealthy. Okay, riches, they're only evil when they impair your soul's health. But there's nothing wrong with having money, even having a lot of money. We've got Job and Abraham and David. God blessed them with lots of wealth, and they were definitely heroes of faith. As Dave Ramsey likes to say, money is amoral. It's like a brick. I mean, you can use a brick for building something or holding something down, or you can throw it through a window or use it to hit someone over the head. The brick doesn't care. Well, the same is true with money. Now, the problem is the love of money and the obsession to get rich. It's the way we view it, acquire it, and use it. As you know, prosperity, it can lead people into a sense of self-sufficiency and thus away from God. And because of that, there are all these exhortations in the Bible that warn us about accumulating a lot of money. For example, Jesus, he spoke of the difficulty of the rich being saved in Matthew 19, 23, and 24. I mean, the Bible certainly doesn't hold to the common human assessment that riches are always good and poverty is always bad. Well, looking at the Bible, we might say there are four kinds of people. Well, first of all, those who are rich in the world's goods but poor toward God, like the rich fool in Luke chapter 12. Those who are poor in the world's goods but rich toward God, like Lazarus in Luke chapter 16. Those poor in the world's goods and poor toward God, you know, like the prodigal son before he came to his senses in Luke chapter 15. And those rich in the world's goods and rich toward God, like Abraham in the book of Genesis. And, you know, I've come across, I think, people in all four of these categories. You probably have as well. So, which category are you in? Well, our passage for today, it's mainly concerned with the top two, with the first two categories, the ungodly rich and the godly poor. Now, some people see this section of James as kind of like a court case. Verse 1, it reveals how these ungodly rich should feel because of the charge against them. And then in verses 2 through 6, it lays out the case against them, you know, the evidence. Well, verse 1, come now, you rich, weep and howl for your miseries which are coming upon you. Now, again, this is not every rich person. Okay, this is a certain class of rich people. And we see from verse 6 that they had condemned the righteous man. So it's probably not speaking of rich Christians. Rather, it's those who are mistreating Christians. See, I think this section is primarily here to encourage the poor Christians who are being afflicted and try to discourage them from being jealous of those with money and power, which is really easy to do because I want that yacht, you see. Anyway, this could certainly apply to any Christian, of course, who falls into it. But weep in hell, you know, obviously suggesting the expression of utter woe. Miseries refers to the wretchedness of their circumstances. But this is the exact opposite of what you'd expect. And this is probably the opposite of what they're thinking. I mean, why should we weep and howl? Things are great. We're insulated against, you know, any difficulties, any hard times by all this stuff that we've accumulated. As in the 80s song, I don't worry because my wallet's fat. See, in their eyes, their net worth, it establishes their self-worth. But if they truly understood their fate, if they could truly see it, they would literally shriek over the prospect. So James, he laid out the details of the court case and the evidence against them. So Exhibit A, verses 2 through 3. Let's read this together. Your riches have rotted and your garments have become moth-eaten. Your gold and your silver have rusted, and their rust will be a witness against you and will consume your flesh like fire. It is in the last days that you have stored up your treasure. And this immediately brings to mind what Jesus said, of course, in Matthew chapter 6. Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys and where thieves do not break in or steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. So James began painting this picture of the true condition of their wealth that had consumed and, you know, taken hold of their hearts and their affections. And maybe as it's seen from God's perspective. See, these riches, they're rotted, they are moth-eaten, they're rusted. And rust, that's certainly something my family is familiar with, as we used to live really close to the ocean. Metal doesn't last long in the salty ocean air. You know, obviously gold and silver, they don't actually rust. That's the oxidation of iron. But I believe this Greek word was also used for becoming tarnished, which silver and gold certainly can happen to them in different ways. But he's probably just using figurative language here. He's trying to paint a picture to make his point. They expected their gold and silver to last, well, forever. But you can't put your trust in it. It cannot deliver the permanence that it promises. It's not going to be there to help them out of the coming miseries. You might recall Jesus' statement about the deceitfulness of riches in Matthew 13, 22. Lenski, he made the comment, as far as these rich are concerned, as far as these things are supposed to make them rich, these things are like a lot of rotten, moth-eaten, rusted stuff that deserves to be thrown out. People who have nothing better are the most wretched beggars. Their gold and their silver are like iron that is rusted through and through or rusted clean away. And James, he said that this corroded condition of their wealth is going to stand in judgment to testify against them. And so they're unused, they're hoarded, they're corroded riches, they're going to take the stand and they're going to testify. And the point may be that they're rotting from being unused. You see, for the rich fool in Jesus' parable, in Luke 12, he didn't know what to do with all of his extra grain. He didn't know where to put it. It was quite the conundrum. It was quite the dilemma. I mean, what's he going to do with it? Well, how about the mouths of the widows and the orphans and the truly needy in his community? Now, how about using some of it in the support of God's work? Now he never saw past himself. Well, James said that the testimony, it's so condemning that it will consume your flesh like fire. And he may have been painting the picture of the rust. It's spreading from their gold and silver onto them. And not just that, but with the fierceness of fire. Rust and fire are known for their destroying powers. And as you know, fire is often used as a judgment figure to depict the ultimate ends of those who are not, as James 2:5 says, rich in faith and love God. I've heard it put like this: the testimony of the evidence will be so damning that you might say it lights the fire of their punishment. Well, James also showed the folly of this mad pursuit because it's in the last days that you have stored up your treasure. So what does that mean? Well, some people think it's speaking of the last days of Judaism, and it's referring to the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. And many of the rich Jews who had oppressed their Christian brethren, they certainly did weep and howl during that time as the Romans just defeated and killed them. I think, though, last days probably just speaking of the Christian age. You know, as Peter spoke at the beginning of his Pentecost sermon in Acts 2, he quoted from Joel, which was, it spoke of what would happen in the last days. This is the last period of time for God's creation. The next great event in the universe is going to be the second coming of Christ along with the judgment day. And since judgment could come at any time in these last days, you know, at any moment, it's foolish to waste all of our time pursuing what's only temporary and what wears out. See, these rich people, they had stored up earthly stuff as if, you know, they'd live forever on this earth and they'd be able to use it forever. And of course, reminded again about the rich fool in Jesus' parable. He had so much wealth that he had to build bigger barns, and yet, what happened? He died that very night. I mean, what use was all that wealth to him then? Well, Orbison gave the illustration. If you could accumulate all the food in the world, that would not guarantee that you would eat breakfast in the morning. These rich had not used their resources wisely. They were greedy and self-absorbed, but finally the day of reckoning will come to them. Okay, Exhibit B, verse 4. Let's continue reading. Behold, the pay of the laborers who mowed your fields, and which has been withheld by you, cries out against you, and the outcry of those who did the harvesting has reached the ears of the Lord of Sabaoth. Well, as you know, the Bible is just filled with all these admonitions, all these passages that refer to honesty and integrity and justice. Well, mowed your fields, that's just a way of speaking of doing the reaping, not the neighbor boy with his lawnmower. Well, in the season of reaping, landowners, they could really make a small fortune. And so this made the crime withholding the wages of the workers even more shameful. It's not that they were without the funds to pay them, you see. Rather, they greedily kept the funds for themselves. So how could they justify doing this? I don't know. Perhaps there were trumped-up charges against the workers. Or they found some kind of legal loophole. Or maybe the landowner was just conveniently out of town on payday. Or he gave them, well, maybe he gave them part of the money and then he promised to give the rest later. But as it's been said, there are no limits to the creativity of the greedy. Now, whatever that means, these guys are lining their pockets with the livelihood of the poor. As you know, there are plenty of people today doing the same thing. They're getting rich through dishonest and underhanded means at the expense of others. Hopefully that's not you and me. Now, if these are rich Jews that he's referring to, they had disregarded the demands of the law of Moses. You shall not oppress a hired servant who is poor and needy, whether he is one of your countrymen or one of your aliens, speaking of a foreigner, not a little green man, who is in your land, in your towns. Here it is. You shall give him his wages on his day before the sun sets, for he is poor and sets his heart on it, so that he may not cry against you to the Lord and it become sin in you. Deuteronomy 24. You see, for the really poor, well, what's the deal? If they don't receive pay at the end of each day, they don't eat. And so the Jews, they weren't allowed to retain the wages of the hired workmen for even one night. Well, James said that it's these withheld wages that cry out against them and testify against them. As Abel's blood, you know, shed by his brother Cain, cried out to God from the ground, Genesis 4. Well, on top of that, the outcry of the workers themselves has reached the ears of the Lord of Sabaoth, or hosts, speaking of armies. The name refers to God's ultimate control over all of creation, and the fact that everything's at his disposal to use, whether that's an army of men, of locusts, of angels, whatever. And it is often used in the Old Testament to speak of his power, and especially bringing judgment. So these rich people, okay, they're not listening to the entreaties of the poor whom they're defrauding, but God will. And those who deprive the poor of their hard-earned wages, well, guess what? They are no match for this one whom they must ultimately give an account. And he doesn't take bribes. The rich, they thought that they could cheat these workers, they could get away with it, because the poor, well, they often don't have anyone to defend them. But on the contrary, what's the reality? The defender of the poor is the Almighty. And he, you know, he hears their cry, he will grant them justice in the end. So everyone needs to ask the question, is that bit of money unfairly obtained worth it? Is it worth the ultimate cost? All right, Exhibit C, verse 5, let's read. You've lived luxuriously on the earth and led a life of wanton pleasure. You have fattened your hearts in a day of slaughter. Well, as J.W. Roberts said, the wages fraudulently kept back were used to live luxurious and self-indulgent lives, thus adding to the flagrance of their crime. The expression on the earth is possibly James's way of indicating that this condition is temporary. Only on earth, not for long here, will this indulgent use of ill-gotten gain last. We will take with us neither our money, 1 Timothy 6:7, nor the pleasures it buys. Their life of wanton pleasure, it paints a picture of this wasteful self-indulgence, while those who they've cheated, they're doing without. Now again, the problem is not in having wealth. It's rather to live this kind of life by means of ill-gotten gain. And they're also, it kind of seems to be implied the problem of the way that they used it, because wanton, it means wasteful, okay? It means unrestrained and excessive type of thing. Obviously, if your neighbor's children are starving to death, and you're taking a milk bath every night in your solid gold bathtub, there's a problem. And so it's not just the way they got it, it's the way that they used it, simply for fleshly indulgence. If we just live for the here and now, guess what? We are not pleasing in the sight of God. Paul, he told Timothy to instruct the rich to do good, to be rich in good works, to be generous and ready to share, storing up for themselves the treasure of a good foundation for the future, so that they may take hold of that which is life indeed. This life is not life indeed, and so we better not live as though it is. The day of slaughter, that's an expression probably depicting the day of God's judgment. And the idea of fattening your hearts, it might bring to mind our modern feedlots, where cattle, you know, they're fed to put on weight before being sold at auction for slaughter. If, as if these rich, okay, they're preparing their hearts for the judgment of God, they're preparing for a destiny of slaughter. They're like the cattle in the feedlot. The cattle, they're enjoying their good meals and their lazy and lavish lifestyle, completely unaware of what's coming. Hamburgers. Yes, they were riding in first class, but the destination is, it's not a vacation. And so we've seen the problem of hoarding treasures, defrauding measures, and indulging pleasures. But that's not all. So Exhibit D, verse 6, let's read the last one, last verse. You have condemned and put to death the righteous man. He does not resist you. So here's the climax of their sins. Some think that James was referring to Jesus as the righteous man they condemned and put to death. Yeah, it was the rich and the powerful, the influential who did that. But because of verse 7, I think he's just talking about a Christian in general. Well, put to death, it may be referring to the fact that since the wages were withheld, the poor were condemned to die by these self-indulgent people because they don't have the things that they need. They're not able to buy the things. Or he could be saying that the righteous, they wouldn't get justice in a court of law when opposed by these rich. In chapter 2 and verse 6, over there, James, he mentioned that the rich would drag Christians into court. And if you think about it, okay, the rich could easily use their influence and or their money to bribe the judges in order to sway a decision in their favor. But just because you get away with something here on this earth, it doesn't mean you got away with it. We might think of Ahab and Jezebel and getting Naboth's vineyard in 1 Kings 21. So they used their power and their influence to get him wrongly executed. But God saw it when he sent his prophet to Ahab. You ought to read that sometime. Now, again, I think righteous man is speaking of a Christian being defrauded by these rich who are not followers of the Lord. And perhaps, well, he doesn't resist because, well, he cannot. But if you think about it, a Christian is often an easy person to cheat and to treat badly, since they're taught things like turning the other cheek and praying for their enemies and never taking revenge. You know, we find passages like 1 Peter chapter 2, "For you have been called for this purpose, since Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example for you to follow in his steps, who committed no sin, nor was any deceit found in his mouth. And while being reviled, he did not revile in return. While suffering, he uttered no threats, but kept entrusting himself to him who judges righteously." There have been plenty of people throughout time who have tried to take advantage and exploit that. So James, he presented to the judge and the jury the evidence, and it demands only one verdict. Guilty. Okay, case closed. And so we hear the echo of the gavel as the verdict rings throughout the universe. Well, verse 7, the exhortation is given, "Be patient, therefore, brethren." And so he went on to change the subject matter from those afflicting to those afflicted, his poor Christian brethren. But if you think about it, okay, compared to most people in the world, people who either live now or have lived in the past, 21st century American Christians are extremely, I mean, they could very easily, we are so blessed, could easily be considered rich. Holloway made the comment, "With his strong language against the rich, one wonders what James would think of the wealth of the typical American church member. Most of us reject the charge that we are rich. The rich are those with more than we have. As a student of mine once said, in all sincerity, we're not rich. We live in a two-story house. Rich people have three-story houses." You see, historically, we live at the level, okay, a level of luxury and abundance that only kings and queens could imagine. I mean, if our internet is slow, or it takes over 5 minutes to get our fast food, well, we're looking up the passages in the Bible on suffering. Man, we've got it pretty good. We just got to make sure that this section could not be applied to us. See, often the more we have, well, the more we want. And then if we're not careful, then we're cheating others, or we're breaking the law, we're hoarding our money, and we're failing to use it for good. And again, money is not the problem. It's the love of money. It's greed. Don't forget about the rich fool. So is the man who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. And, well, one way, I think, to help us to avoid falling into this is what we are celebrating this week, and that is Thanksgiving. See, we look at the world around us, and we recognize that there are so many people, they refuse to even acknowledge that God exists, much less give him thanks. But you and I know better. And so this Thursday, we are going to sit down and thank God for just the bountiful spread before us and all the other blessings. See, we know who ultimately provides for us. We know that every blessing that we enjoy can ultimately, it can be traced to the God who made us, and we know that life would be miserable and it would be hopeless without him.